Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to get notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. And an article from the New York Times by Catherine Skip and Damian Cave called At Legal Fringe, Empty Houses Go to the Needy. Save Florida Homes, Inc. and its owner, Mark Garrett, have found foreclosed homes for several needy families in Broward County, and his tenants could not be more pleased. Fabian Ferguson, his wife, and two children now live in a two-bedroom home they have transformed from damaged and abandoned to full and cozy. There's just one problem. Mr. Garrett is not the owner yet. In a sign of the odd ingenuity that has grown from the real estate collapse, he is banking on an 1869 Florida statute that says the bundle of properties he has seized will be his if the owners do not claim them within 7 years. A version of the same law was used in the 1850s to claim possession of runaway slaves, though Mr. Garrett, 47, a clean-cut mortgage broker, sees his efforts as heroic. There are all these properties out there that could be used for good, he said. The North Lauderdale authorities, though, see him as a crook. He is scheduled to go on trial in December on fraud charges in a case that, along with a handful of others in Florida and in other states, could determine whether maintaining a property and paying taxes on it is enough to lead to ownership. Legal scholars say the concept is old, rooted in Renaissance England, when agricultural land would sometimes go fallow, left untended by long-lost heirs. It is also common. All 50 states allow for so-called adverse possession, with the time to forge a kind of common law marriage with property varying from a few years in most states to several decades in New Jersey. The statute generally requires that properties be maintained openly and continuously, which usually means paying property taxes and utility bills. It is not clear how many people are testing the idea, but lawyers say that do-it-yourself possession cases have been popping up all over the country, and, they note, these self-proclaimed owners play an odd role in a real estate mess that never seems to end. Though they may cringe at the analogy, as squatters with bank accounts, these adverse possessors are like leeches, and it can be difficult to tell at times whether they are cleaning a wound already there or making it worse. Either way, Florida is where they thrive. Many residents of the Sunshine State have grown accustomed to living beside a home left vacant for years. Now, hundreds of these mold-filled caverns, their appliances long ago spirited off, are being claimed by strangers. There are all kinds of ways the people try to manipulate the system to their own financial gain, said Jack McCabe, an independent real estate analyst with McCabe Research and Consulting. And you're going to see it here because Florida is the capital of real estate fraud. Mr. Garrett, who now faces up to 15 years in prison, insists that his business is legitimate and moral. He said he got started last year driving around working-class neighborhoods in Palm Beach and Broward counties looking for a particular kind of home, not just those with overgrown lawns and broken windows, but houses with a large orange sticker from the county reading, "Public Nuisance." The stickers signaled owners out of touch. the county or city were unable to reach them. Mr. Garrett filed court claims on around 100 of these properties, which appear to be in the process of foreclosure. Then he chose 20 that could be most easily renovated and sent letters to the owners and their banks, presumably overwhelmed, to make them aware of his plans. Florida does not require notification. One state lawmaker tried and failed to close that loophole last year with a bill that never passed. But it hardly mattered. 19 of the owners and their banks did not respond, Mr. Garrett said. So, he set about fixing up the unclaimed properties. In some cases, he just mowed the lawn and replaced stolen air conditioners or broken windows. In other cases, like with Mr. Ferguson, he let tenants make improvements in lieu of rent. At his peak last year, he said he managed 17 homes with renters, some of whom he found on Craigslist, and others through a Christian ministry in Margate, Florida. Copies of leases show Mr. Garrett included an addendum noting that he was not the legal owner. Tenants like Mr. Ferguson and his family, who had been homeless before moving in last year and paying $289 a month, see Mr. Garrett as a savior. And the neighbors generally agree. There is no telling who was in and out of that house, said Raul Thomas, who lives next door to Mr. Ferguson and his family. I like them, and I'd much rather have someone in there than the house empty. In other cases, though, adverse possession has been more aggressive and problematic. In Palm Beach County, Carl Heflin spent a year in jail awaiting trial on fraud, trespassing, and burglary charges. But after accepting a plea agreement and the rejection of his adverse possession claims, he was arrested again on charges of trying to collect back rents on houses he had tried to possess. The whole time he was harassing us and threatened to burn the house down with my kids in it, said Misty Hall, a single mother of two, who rented a home from Mr. Heflin. Sam Gorin, city attorney for North Lauderdale, said any benefits were outweighed by a simple fact that adverse possessors often overlook. They are trespassing. Michael Allen Wolf, a real estate expert at the University of Florida Law School, said adverse possessors also disrupt the chain of title. Rightful owners end up having to evict tenants. The time between foreclosure and legitimate resale may be extended. Even when adverse possessors help stabilize neighborhoods, it is not an effective or efficient cure for the foreclosure crisis in Florida, Peter Wolf said. Mr. Garrett said his goals are more charitable. After several marriages, 6 children, and some minor trouble with the law, he said, he is now a born-again Christian who sees his new company as a way to make an honest living and solve a dire need. His tenants confirmed that after he was arrested in April, he told them they could stop paying rent. Even if he is not allowed to keep taking homes, he said, why should needy people not be matched with homes left to decay? There are over 4,000 homeless in Broward, and the number is growing all the time, he said. I thought I could use these homes and put people into them. It could be a good thing. He added, it's not rocket science. And that's from an article in the New York Times, At Legal Fringe, Empty Houses Go to the Needy, which is the discussion of the adverse possession law that states have on the books dating back to the time in England when people could gain legal title to property by actual possession of the property they don't own, using the property openly and notoriously, exclusively using the property, continuous use of the property, and using the property in a way which is considered adverse use against the intention or claims of all other people. So this is a fascinating attempt to try to rectify some issues in the foreclosure morass across the country, particularly Florida. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond.
Now I'd like to continue our look, which we've been going over for some weeks now, of an investigative series of articles from the Boston Globe about debt collectors in the whole system of debt collection. and how this has impacted on people who are struggling with debt. The umbrella title is Debtor's Hell, and we've been looking at a court system compromised in the last show, and how the debt collection system has been a big bargain for big debt collectors. For the most part, defendant debtors just roll with the punches, and some of those punches are knockouts. But let's look at the case of an 85-year-old widow from Doxbury, Massachusetts, Margaret Donnelly, who fought back. She was living on Social Security and suffering from congestive heart disease. Donnelly was barely making ends meet in her financial world. Struggling to cover the cost of her medications and her electric bills, she said she was stunned when a Plymouth County deputy sheriff appeared at her door with a warrant for her arrest. He said she had been sued for $1,471 and had missed her court date, and this was critical in Massachusetts, going to court. Now, this was an old fight with Chase Manhattan Bank over a Visa card concerning her account and coming back to haunt her, one she thought had long since been resolved. Determined to set the matter straight, she went to Plymouth District Court and on her own filed a motion to remove the judgment against her, despite pressure from clerk officials to get it over with and pay. "It's absolutely appalling," Donnelly said. "The people who tell you to just pay it." At a hearing on the motion, the collection law firm Luster, Glazer, and Wilson asked the court for more time to gather evidence to support its claim, a very common request as debt collectors often start with limited information about the debt owed. In the meantime, however, the court allowed the firm to put a lien on Donnelly's condominium. After nearly a year and two trips to the court, Donnelly was still demanding proof, and Lustig, Glazer, and Wilson could produce none. Finally, the law firm threw in the towel, and the case was dismissed. The managing partner of the law firm, Kenneth Wilson, said he could not comment on the Donnelly matter because federal and state laws bar discussion of debt cases with outside parties. But one of the catches is that clerks routinely give plaintiffs, which is the debt collector or the creditor, the benefit of the doubt, and basic questions of fact are rarely asked or answered. Might the plaintiff's claim be false or overstated? Might they be after the wrong person? Was there proper service? And often they are after the wrong person. I've had it happen to me a number of times with my bankruptcy clients. The Globe gives an example. George Rodriguez of New Bedford twice had to go to court over a $1,665 North Star bill that was not his. Both times, the DHL driver had to take off time from work, costing him $200 a day, to convince the court it had the wrong guy. The North Star debt belonged to a different George Rodriguez, ending with a Z rather than an S. The fellow that North Star was after was 21, and Rodriguez was twice his age. But in court, it was Rodriguez who was faced with the burden of proving he was innocent. And this just goes to show how the system can be skewed. "How many times can I show them my information?" Rodriguez said. The clerk would not accept Rodriguez's proof of his identity. He insisted on a hearing, at which North Star's lawyer finally dropped the case. And that's an important point. When there is resistance and attorneys are involved on the offensive, they will often put the case on the bottom of files that they have, which are massive. They go for the easy ones, which bring them income, and many of those cases eventually get dropped because the law firm does not want to deal with it. But historically, the way it was meant to be in small claims court was that two people without lawyers would be facing one another. But reality has outstripped that notion. Defendants hardly ever have lawyers, while the corporate plaintiffs almost always do. And what is bothersome is that the collection lawyers sometimes seem to direct the hearings. For example, in the article discussing a Framingham District Court session, the clerk's chair sat empty for 15 minutes after the scheduled 1:30 start of the session. Two collection attorneys moved to fill the gap. With clipboards and stacks of paperwork, they stood at the front of the courtroom, calling out defendants' names and asking them to come forward. They negotiated some cases and scheduled others for future dates, all with no clerk present. One defendant, Loretta Jenkins, was there on her lunch break. She discussed her debt with a lawyer whom she thought was the district attorney. In other words, not the creditor's attorney. The lawyer told her not to bother waiting for the magistrate, but to get this over with and get back to work. So she signed a payment agreement and left. By the time the clerk magistrate, Thomas Begley, entered the courtroom, the majority of the cases had been dispensed with. There was no one to ensure that the defendants had not been pressured into payments they could ill afford. The head judge of the whole system, Judge Connolly, speaking generally, defended the right of litigants at any level of the court system to settle their differences without the supervision of a clerk or judge. And this is true not just in Massachusetts, but in all 50 states. But Engler, the New England School of Law professor, said lawyers too often take advantage of debtors in such unsupervised conversations. It is, he said, ethically improper for plaintiff lawyers to advise debtors what to do. And that's a very critical point. They are not working for the debtors. It's up to the court to monitor this behavior. The court has to give it something other than a rubber stamp, he said. The magistrate in this particular situation said he didn't know that defendants were confused about the role of lawyers. Subsequently, a few days later, he posted a letter to attorneys in his court telling them not to speak to defendants before the start of hearings and requiring all parties to stay until their payment deals are reviewed. We won't accept any further agreements until we see both parties, he said. So that's definitely progress. But most clerks, who in Massachusetts are the magistrates, take the common position. When it comes to specifically informing debtors of their rights, they want to avoid any appearance of advocacy. They therefore feel it's not proper to tell debtors they can dispute a debt or demand documentation of it, or that if they are on public assistance, they can't be forced to use that money to satisfy a judgment. Now, the Globe observed only at the Boston Municipal Court a clerk carefully questioning defendants about their ability to pay, and it was only there in all their investigation. At one session, an assistant clerk magistrate, Patrick Mullaney, asked each debtor whether he or she had a job and could truly afford the payments they were agreeing to make. He asked if they were on any kind of public assistance, and if so, told them the case would be dropped for a year. His response was, one part of the government is giving them something to get by. It doesn't make any sense that another part of the government is ordering them to pay money. And even the plaintiff's lawyers at the Boston Municipal Court ask defendants if they have the means to pay because the clerk magistrate requires them to do so. The Chief Justice, Connolly, said the courts must rely on the good faith of the lawyers who appear before them to uphold the rules. But with so many unrepresented debtors going up against lawyers, she acknowledged there's an imbalance there. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And I'll get back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And let's continue to talk about what the consumer debtors are going through. There is an exacerbation of imbalances in the whole collection system by widespread practice in debt cases, and that's the use of covering attorneys. Now, what's a covering attorney? These are legal practitioners who are paid small sums by collection firms to raise their hand and say, "Here," when a case is called. They appear at courts around the state of Massachusetts, often representing as many as a dozen plaintiffs in a single session. And they typically know only the bare bones facts of a given case, a name, and the sum that's supposedly owed. That's it. But here's the imbalance. Covering lawyers usually don't need to know anything more. They're simply there to collect default judgments against people who don't show up. So the Globe went to court and they looked at the issue of covering lawyers. In Lowell, Massachusetts, at hearings, a handful of covering lawyers had only to say plaintiff for the record, and they said it 132 times. Their work was done in 90 of those cases because the defendants did not appear. So we have a system in which the defaults are rampant and where debtors in many courts are presumed to owe the money. So some clerks make it part of their job to assist the plaintiffs, even those who skip hearing in the way that flout court rules. For example, it's a common scene in the windowless basement room in New Bedford District Court where Assistant Clerk Magistrate Thomas Alphonse often runs overflowing small claims sessions. When a plaintiff fails to respond to the call of a lawsuit, and now the plaintiff is the creditor or debt collector in these cases, the judge routinely prompts Joseph McIntyre, New Bedford's lead covering lawyer, to pick up the case, even though under the rules, such cases should be dismissed. During one busy session last fall, Alphonse asked, "Anyone want to answer for Mr. Bast?" referring to a lawyer not present that day. McIntyre said he would pick up the case. When no one spoke up to cover a sovereign bank lawsuit, McIntyre jumped in. "I'll answer for them." Similarly, on a Bank of America case, Alphonse coached. That's Daniel's office. Again, McIntyre obliged. And when a lesser-known firm, Natchco, had its suit called and no one responded, Alphonse asked McIntyre to represent the no-show plaintiff. McIntyre said, "My incentive is volume." He answers for up to 10 plaintiffs a day and makes $10 to $15 per case, basically doing nothing except being there. The Natco case illustrates two common abuses of the system. First, the case should have been dismissed when the plaintiff did not appear. Second, the judge violated court rules when he granted McIntyre a postponement because the lawyer was, not surprisingly, unprepared to try the case. These clerk magistrates routinely grant these delays, which lawyers call continuances, when the plaintiff's lawyers say they need time to prepare. Defendants are almost never shown such deference. Mr. Sturgiotis and his wife, owners of a pizza shop, had been sued by Natco. They were outraged that the case was continued. If they want to bring you to court and they expect you to be there, they should be there too, said the Sturgiotises. Asked in an interview why he didn't dismiss the case when neither the plaintiff nor its lawyer appeared, the judge said, "It's more paper, more court dates. It's better if we work it out today for everybody." We had in an earlier show discussed a case of an Iraq veteran, a Mr. Damon, who had flown home to Massachusetts from Washington, D.C. for his hearing. The court allowed the plaintiff's attorney a continuance, even after realizing that this man had come by an expensive airplane flight to attend the hearing. When the Globe asked the clerk magistrate why he allowed the delay, he said, "If Mr. Damon had no idea that he could object to a continuance, it's not the clerk's responsibility to tell him." Back to the chief judge, Judge Connolly. In a letter to the Globe, she pointed to the text of the state standards for small claim proceedings, which strongly discourage such continuances. It says, if the attorney isn't prepared to prove his or her case, the matter should be dismissed unless there is a showing of good cause. Going back to the Iraq veterans case, the magistrate said it was not his job to question why the plaintiff had, under oath, indicated to the court that Mr. Damon was not in military service when he was. The president of that creditor corporation said in a letter to the Globe that he did not know that Mr. Damon was in the Army. But Damon and his mother said they told that debt collector many times that he was deployed to Iraq and then in a military hospital. Now, with all of this, the ultimate threat in debt cases is a resurgence of jail time for failure to pay. In Massachusetts, it is a threat routinely used by court officials, lawyers, and constables to force compliance by defendants. One example, a constable who had brought debtors in under threat of arrest was haranguing several of them in the hallway, as witnessed by the Globe investigators. One woman, Deborah Menderos, owed $700 to an auto salvage company. The constable, Trent Roderick, told her to come up with the money or he'd send her before a judge who might lock her up. "I'm going to jail," Medeiros sobbed, tears flowing down her face. In a panic, she called her father, who came to court with the cash. Paul Fournier, a covering lawyer in several Western Massachusetts courts, warned debtors in the hallway in Springfield District Court that they'll be incarcerated if they lie on court forms. And he said jail threats can be effective. Some judges, if they have trouble with debtors, he said, will put the cuffs on them and make a big show of it, and the money comes out from everywhere. The relatives come out and everything. Mark Marcelin, a 53-year-old Haitian immigrant, didn't get to his relatives in time. On the morning of December 13th, two constables arrived at Marcelin's home in Brockton. They handcuffed him and drove him to Quincy District Court, where he sat in the lockup of one of the state's dingiest courthouses for nearly 6 hours. At 3 p.m., he was called before Judge Mark Coven. "So you haven't come up with the money?" Coven asked. Marcelin was being sued by Madeline Corden of Randolph for failing to do a contracting job. She had paid him $2,000 to put vinyl siding on her house. He did 2 days' work, but then didn't return her calls for 6 days, facts that Marcelin, in an interview, did not dispute. Corden sued him, and Marcelin twice failed to show up for court, which again, in Massachusetts, is part of the problem. Marcelin was no stranger to the court system, having faced charges years earlier for using drugs, but that was not the matter before the court on this day. Indeed, he had no idea how high the stakes were when he left home that morning. Standing before Coven, Marcelin told the judge his sister was supposed to be coming to court with money. "Is she coming today?" Coven, the magistrate, asked twice, according to an audio tape of the session. Marcelin was not sure. Coven told him he was being found in contempt of court and ordered that you'd be held at the Dedham House of Correction to be released on payment of $2,300, including fees and interest. After a long silence, Coven asked, "Do you understand that?" Under the law, a judge can fine a debtor $200 for contempt or put him in jail for up to 30 days in Massachusetts. Coven did not give Marcelin a chance to contact a lawyer, as the Massachusetts court standards recommend. There is no constitutional right to a lawyer in civil cases. When Marcelin's sister called the court that day to arrange payment to free him, she said a court clerk told her not to bother because he also owed money to Brockton District Court. The clerk made the same comment about Marcelin's situation to a Globe reporter that day. And Marcelin, he was locked up for 28 days. Coven defended his ruling. "He had the keys to the jail cell," Coven said. "All I was trying to do was to get a court order satisfied." And next week, we will continue by looking behind the badge. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I am speaking
from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt manageable life.